From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terri Gross with Fresh Air. Mamoun Fandi spent 2 years in Saudi Arabia interviewing clerics who preach an extreme form of Islam. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with him about the roots of extreme Islamic movements and the rise of Osama bin Laden. Fandi interviewed bin Laden, second in command, and devotes a chapter to bin Laden in the book Saudi Arabia and the Politics of Dissent. Fandi is a professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. Also, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz talks about why music hasn't been the source of comfort that it was during the Gulf War. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've been trying to understand the motivations of the terrorists who attacked us. My guest Mamoun Fendi has followed the development of extremist Islamist groups in Saudi Arabia, including Osama bin Laden's group. Fendi spent 2 years in Saudi Arabia interviewing dissident Saudi clerics who preached an extremist form of Islam. He also collected, translated, and analyzed 150 taped sermons. Fendi's book, Saudi Arabia and the Politics of Dissent, was published in 1999. Fendi recently left Georgetown University's Center for Contemporary Arab Studies to become a professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies, which is affiliated with the National Defense University. He grew up in Egypt. Earlier today, I asked him when and why he started interviewing dissident clerics in Saudi Arabia.
I started interviewing some of them immediately after the Gulf War. So the project started in 1994. And my main concern was that probably we've seen all these Islamist movements throughout the Middle East, some of them in countries that are very poor. And the theory has always been that these are poor people who are deprived of economic and political rights. And then you have this phenomenon in a country that's extremely rich, like Saudi Arabia. So the question was, why would these people get involved in issues of dissent, as well as some of them might engage in violent acts? So it was curious for me to look at this puzzle that's extremely different from the rest of the movements, whether they are in Egypt or Algeria or Morocco or in the occupied territories.
And what better illustration than Osama bin Laden, who comes from an extremely wealthy family and has a lot of money on his own. So what are some of the answers that you found? What were some of the reasons that these clerics became very extreme in their thinking?
Well, some of the answers really relate to Saudi Arabia itself. But one interesting aspect is the kind of connection that some of these groups have straddled the borderlines of international politics, in a sense that it's really became a global question in a way. Some of their websites and cassette tapes and other things started to reflect strands of thoughts from other movements that are not Islamist, like the Zapatistas in southern Mexico, or other violent groups in the Tamil Tigers and other groups. So there was a great deal of globalization of dissent and resistance, as well as violence. But some of these movements, like some clerics were relating their issues to Saudi Arabia specifically, and there was a great deal of anger at corrupt practices within the kingdom. But I think the most interesting aspect of all of this is really the what I call it borderline dissidents, those who straddle international borders and moved into failed states like Somalia, Sudan, and Afghanistan, and connected with other local groups, whether they are in Egypt or in Saudi Arabia or in Algeria.
And why did they do that? Why did they move to countries like that?
Well, because some of these countries, like whether Saudi Arabia or Egypt, have extreme measures in dealing with dissent. So most of them, it is not something like the United States, where the state is fighting with one hand tied behind its back by its constitutions and laws and other things. In places like Saudi Arabia and Egypt, these measures were extremely harsh, so these people fled. But one other component that's very specific to Saudi Arabia was that in the 1980s, there was the jihad in Afghanistan, or resisting the whole Soviet occupation in Afghanistan. So there was a great deal of charitable organizations within Saudi Arabia supporting fellow Muslims in Afghanistan. So there was a nod, actually, from the ruling elite in Saudi Arabia, the government of Saudi Arabia, as well as the United States at the time. They encouraged these people. So they left for Afghanistan, and they came back to Saudi Arabia after they called it the defeat of the evil empire. when they came back to Saudi Arabia, they were they came during the Gulf War, especially Osama bin Laden, and asked the royal family. He asked the royal family to fight Saddam Hussein with his Afghan men or the Mujahideen that came with him from Afghanistan. Of course, the royal family refused his offer, and he had to flee to leave for Sudan. But the idea is really the main frustration of these groups who went to Afghanistan and fought. They thought they would receive a hero welcome when they came back. And some of them came very much, more or less, shell-shocked and confused and all of that. And when they went home, they realized that the population did not care that much about international issues like Afghanistan. So there was a great deal of disappointment. And when he left, when Osama bin Laden left for Sudan, he started his whole jihad campaign against Saudi Arabia and against its global patron, if you will, the United States, from Sudan.
So you're saying that one of the things that alienated bin Laden is that at the time of the Gulf War, he offered his own troops to Saudi Arabia to defend them. Saudi Arabia turned them down and made a deal with the United States instead. So you think he took that very personally?
I think for some of them, they felt that the Saudi regime is redeemable in a way, and if it had Islamic forces that will fight on its behalf, they might accept it. But at that point, they felt the Saudi alliance with the United States is extremely strong, and this is when he launched his campaign from Sudan against Saudi Arabia and against the United States. Now, both the United States and Saudi Arabia pressured the Sudanese government to let Osama bin Laden leave Sudan. But really, it is that Sudan experience that created Osama bin Laden as we know him today.
You interviewed many Saudi dissident clerics, extreme Islamists.
That's right.
Where does bin Laden fit in? Now, I know you didn't personally interview bin Laden, but you certainly know a lot about him. Where does he fit in to this larger group? I mean, he's now very well known by all of us in the United States, or at least we know about him through the media. The other extremists are less well known to us. Why did bin Laden become the main power broker?
I think partly because bin Laden was a wealthy man. He inherited some $262 million from his family fortune. Before the coming of bin Laden as we know him today, the bin Laden group or the bin Laden family was really in some kind of symbiotic relationship with the ruling family of Saudi Arabia. It's a big construction company that ran the major projects of Saudi Arabia. They built all kinds of projects, from the renovation of the two holy mosques to major roads in Saudi Arabia. So bin Laden was the man with really the means to actually recruit and pay some of these people, and he was the major fundraiser in Saudi Arabia on behalf of Muslim fighters in Chechnya and Bosnia and other places. So in a sense, Osama bin Laden is different from the rest. The rest were really more of reformists who want the regime to open up and to democratize and other things. Osama felt that this is something that need to be eradicated completely because of that special relationship of Saudi Arabia with the United States. I did not interview Osama directly, but I interviewed his number two man who was in London at the time, and I met him in London. His name is Khalid Al-Fawaz, and he was picked up by the British, actually, after the first World Trade Center attack. And it was obvious in their language and their ideological orientation, as well as the network, that these people who are really interested in violence, and in a sense, they are really different. They learned their lessons from the Egyptian Jihad and other violent movements throughout.
My guest is Mamoun Fendi, a professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies, which is affiliated with the National Defense University. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mamoun Fendi, author of the book Saudi Arabia and the Politics of Dissent, which is based on his interviews with extremist clerics. What else did you learn about the Bin Laden network by interviewing Bin Laden's number two?
What I learned is that actually these guys, there were two components. One is that these guys sincerely believed that somehow they defeated the first superpower, Soviet Union at the time, and they are willing to take on the only left superpower and the what they call it, the leader of the capitalist system, that's the United States. So there was that adamant kind of attitude towards the United States.
Can I stop you a second? When you say that they sincerely believe that they defeated the Soviets, are you implying there that they really didn't do that single-handedly? They defeated them because the CIA was involved too, and they're forgetting that?
They're forgetting that there were all kinds of, not just the CIA, but all kinds of regional players, like Saudi Arabia itself pumped a great deal of money into that Afghan operation. So in a sense, they really sort of, after a while, they started convincing themselves that they are the ones who did it single-handedly, and they are capable to defeat the United States. They have started in London and here in the United States to recruit not the poor Egyptians and poor Sudanese and people like that, but mainly to recruit amongst those who are committed Islamists who are studying engineering and physics and sciences in general to prepare for these operations. I think they felt sincerely that the systems throughout the West are laxed and they can get away with that. And some of them actually didn't know much about the United States in a sense of what are their targets in the United States. It was, for them, the United States is just a global power. But gradually they learned they learned from the media what is the symbolic value of, let's say, a place like the World Trade Center or the Pentagon or something like that. That for them, America was just something amorphous and just this huge power. But the targeting was things that they learned from counterterrorism pamphlets that they translated avidly and things of that sort. So it was very disturbing as I talked to some of these people that actually they read and translate things from the United States that make them more or less identify their targets.
When you interviewed Bin Laden's second in command, did you get the impression that they were planning really a large acts of terrorism? Did you get that sense?
Well, I think that was, that interview took place in 1998, and it was and I had an interview before, but I think there was a major difference between the Bin Laden group. It was a shocking difference between the Bin Laden group and other Saudi dissidents, and I was shocked by the degree of coordination they have with other Islamist groups, mainly the Egyptian Jihad as well as the GIA in Algeria. That's the Armed Islamic Group. It goes by its French acronym. And the level of organization and the level of communication was absolutely disturbing. Did I know of planned acts? I think all their activities were pointing towards that, but I had no specific information of what their plan might be. But I was not surprised by the attack on the embassies in Kenya, and I was not surprised even with the First World Trade Center attack. I was extremely surprised by the September 11th attack, because they were just unbelievable in the level of organization, and it shows that these groups have become very, very sophisticated.
I think that the September 11th attack on the World Trade Center was amazing in its degree of sadism. It mm-hmm. struck me as just a particularly sadistic way for them to make their point. I mean, it was not only violent, it was just violent in a... I can't think of a better word than sadism. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you saw an undertone of that when you were talking to... the second-in-command of bin Laden's group?
I think I talked to not just second-in-command, but other also fringe sort of elements that I suspected they were connected to bin uh-huh. Laden. But there was, in their conversation, you can feel there is a dance of death, that it is really not for Allah and the tribe, as other Islamists would have it. These are people who are really sort of... killing for airtime, for some kind of to see themselves as part of these global heroes. There is a conversion between pop stars and criminality, and the movement acquired a logic of its own that's not necessarily related to the ideology itself. It became part of a world where the line between television picture and real and reality seem to collapse. It's kind of a simulation and simulacre kind of thing, where even their talk about Osama bin Laden was really like talking about Mick Jagger or something like that. It's very confused. So in a way, there's something. There's something mentally wrong in their language and discourse in general that tells you that, as you aptly described it, it is these are people who are in a very sadistic kind of mood, and they see that as sort of a game. It's a game of destruction, and they seem to. Unlike many of us who would be probably scared of the notion of seeing somebody bleeding, these are people who are just they are so callous and their conversation is so antiseptic that the notion of just blood doesn't enter there. It's mainly a notion of. They see the world in terms of TV images and images of destruction and sometimes when you talk to them about incidents that they did and they tell you wasn't that good, there's something disturbing. There's something disturbing. Whenever I had an interview with any of these guys, I always left extremely disturbed about. You know, I mean, is it worth it to do social science research to come out of an interview that disturbed about how the modern world is breeding a certain vicious component or creating monsters out of otherwise would-be human beings?
Mamoun Fendi is a professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies of the National Defense University. He's the author of the book Saudi Arabia and the Politics of Dissent. Our interview was recorded this morning. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From Saab, maker of the 9.5 sedan and the 9.5 wagon. Independent quality and safety evaluations of Saab 9.5's performance available at saabusa.com. From Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of She Still Haunts Me, a novel by Katie Royfe about Lewis Carroll and Alice, his muse. And from Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our discussion about extreme Islamic movements with Professor Mamoun Fendi. He's been studying them since the end of the Gulf War. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz talks about why he hasn't felt much like listening to music lately. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Mamoun Fendi. He's a professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. After the Gulf War, he spent 2 years interviewing extremist Islamist clerics in Saudi Arabia. Fendi translated and analyzed 150 recorded sermons. His book, Saudi Arabia and the Politics of Dissent, includes a chapter on Osama bin Laden. You know, you talk about how some of the people in the network see bin Laden as if he was Mick Jagger. Bin Laden, it seems, would you describe him as really knowing how to use the media, not necessarily the mass media, but, you know, to distribute tapes in which he's the hero of the tape, he's the charismatic leader on the tape. It seems like a lot of the Islamist clerics that you interviewed made names for themselves by their cassette tapes and their videotapes, and in some instances, their canny use of mass media.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think they were uncanny in their ability to use mass media and alternative means of communication. Actually, the internet usage in Saudi Arabia and other places started by the Islamists, and the earliest website that appears on the internet from the Middle East as well as other parts of the world came from Islamist groups. Some of that relates to the notion that throughout the Middle East, actually, the media is government controlled, so people are really hungry for some kind of independent thought. So the cassette was really the underground media in the beginning. Of course, you remember the revolution of Khomeini started with the cassette tapes in Iran in 79. So these people also moved beyond small media like the cassette tape to major media, and they manipulate this media very carefully. And some of them actually they have some of their men, you know, working for major media. Bin Laden lately sent his recent fax to Al Jazeera network in Qatar, and some of the people actually who worked in Al Jazeera network, some of them fought in Afghanistan, and now they are in a three-piece suit having a local show.
You've said that in Saudi Arabia, a lot of the extremist Islamists are educated, they have money, and that distinguishes them from some of the extremists in other Arab countries where they're not necessarily as educated, they don't necessarily have money. I think it's easy to think of people who are prone to conspiracy theories and to stereotyping and extremism as being uneducated and therefore susceptible to outlandish theories and to simplistic conspiracies. How do you explain a more educated group of people falling prey to this? Or not even falling prey, creating these conspiracy theories and creating this extreme stereotyping and hatred?
Well, I think, Terry, if you look at the incidents that took place by the poor versus the rich of Islamists, I mean, the poor have very limited goals in Egypt and in other places. They want the system to open up or they want to be integrated in the system, some of them acting on ideological beliefs. But their tactics are really sort of scare tactics. But it is the rich class that actually engaged in that world of fantasy where television violence and real violence converge. These are people who want to settle scores with the West because they are touched by it. They have come here and studied here, but somehow they don't feel that they fit, and they seem to have a distorted notion, I mean, sort of half-baked ideas about what the West is all about. The poor really don't know the West. They haven't traveled in the West, and they just don't have very specific ideas. But I found out that in most of these Islamists in Saudi Arabia have responses to fundamentalist groups here in the United States and what they think and what they do. There is one of the Saudi Islamists, Safar al-Hawali, wrote a long book and a series that was also broadcast on cassette, a response to Pat Robinson or a response to Jerry Falwell. These are people who really engaged in these global debates, and they connect the regional issues like Arab-Israeli conflict with local issues, and they fancy themselves to be the defenders of the faith, and somehow the traditional ulama or the traditional scholars of religion somehow have been submissive as far as the relationship to the West and the relationship with local governments. So they feel like these are the liberators of Islam, but in their own ways, in that fantasy world where money and criminality and hyper reality sort of converge in a very disturbing way. So in that sense, it's different from the poor who have really sort of their terrorism is sort of small business enterprises, but these people are sort of the mega terror groups in they are transnational. They are the IBM of terror.
What would you say is the agenda, the goals of Al Qaeda? I mean, I know that they want the United States military out of Saudi Arabia. Mm-hmm. What are the other goals? Have they?
I think they started out with very specific goals, like wanting the American military out of Saudi Arabia. They wanted Israel out of the occupied territories. But really, these goals seem to take a back seat to their fight with the United States, because they think the United States is the global patron of many of the moderate Arab regimes in Egypt or in Saudi Arabia. So they feel that they had to take on that major power. But there's something really sort of, if you talk to them, it seemed to me very clearly that these people do not have specific goals, that the dance of violence and death seem to have this sort of effect on them, psychological effect, that it's a high in a way. So the idea of goals seem to take a back seat to that logic of violence. They seem to have become professional groups that they can take over weak states. I mean, they noticed Afghanistan is a defunct place, and now actually they run Afghanistan. I mean, most people talk about the Taliban movement as the leadership in Afghanistan, but in actuality, it is Afghanistan. The head of Afghanistan is really Bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri. As for the rest of the political class, like Mullah Omar and others, they're really coming secondary. And they did that in the Sudan.
My guest is Mamoun Fendi, a professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mamoun Fendi, author of the book Saudi Arabia and the Politics of Dissent, which is based on his interviews with extremist clerics. If Bin Laden is apprehended, or if he's assassinated, and that seems like it might be part of the goal for the alliance, would the network still really be strong?
I think it is a mistake to really make Bin Laden the story. It is the network that's the story. It is one has to think of networks of power, even at the level of states. In this new world, you cannot afford to think of Saudi Arabia as a closed state or the United States as a closed state. What we have now is really sort of networks. Varieties of networks, of flows, if you will. You have a financial flow and the flow of people, flow of technology and guns, flow of ideas and media. All these flows, they constitute what we understand to be our world today. The attack on the World Trade Center was not just the attack on the fixed target. It disrupted the airlines and the movement of people. So what you need to do is really sort of, you can't have a visible power against an invisible enemy. You have to, the alliance has really to mirror Bin Laden's cells. It has to be amorphous and flexible, and to attack these organizations, you have to attack their money flow, their people flow. Draining the swamps is not really the idea, but you have to think of how these people, what kinds of people move across boundaries, what kind of money moves there, how they acquire technology, how do they use the media, how do they manipulate these global flows and become part and parcel of it. It's very surprising that these groups are everywhere. I mean, they have front organizations that they're running legitimate, quote-unquote, legitimate businesses. So you have the first step that was done recently about really taking on the financial network of Al-Qaeda is very important. So Bin Laden, the man, is not as much important as Bin Laden, the web of organizational structures that are connecting in terms of money, media, guns and technology, as well as the variety of global flows, if you will. So to focus on one country at a time is the wrong approach. You have to really attack the whole network itself, the web itself, and the node of power of that web is in Afghanistan.
You grew up in Egypt, and you were educated in Egypt, I believe, before coming to the United States. I'm wondering if any of your friends became extremists. In other words, if you watched extremists develop.
Yes, I did, unfortunately. I finished my college from Assyut University, which is in southern Egypt, in the 1981, actually. And some of the people that I knew at that university, I discovered that year when I was receiving my degree from the college, that they were implicated in the Sadat assassination. And Ayman al-Zawahiri was one of those people who were implicated. Ayman was from the neighboring governorate or state called Minya within Middle Egypt. At that university, there was Najih Ibrahim and Asim Abdul Majid, who became the leaders of the Islamic group, and they have ties to the jihad. And I watched these people at the beginning of post-Iran revolution atmosphere that gripped Egypt, and I was a college student at the time, so I watched them for 4 years.
And what are some of the things you learned from watching them?
At the time, and I think probably best to think with Egyptian eyes rather than with the eyes of a Western intellectual now. But at the time, there was the government of President Sadat thought that the left of Egypt, the communists as well as leftist groups, seemed to dominate the national scene. And he had to combat this to establish his own legitimacy. So he decided to use religion as the legitimating force, and he tried to present himself as the commander of the faithful and use religious symbolism throughout. So at the time, all of a sudden, we saw at the universities that the student unions that used to be dominated by leftist activists all of a sudden became dominated by those Islam-oriented groups whose main focus was to have their women colleagues sort of cover their hairs and things like that. The same pattern, I mean, Sadat played with fire and the fire got him in 1981. And I think we did the same when we encouraged these groups in Afghanistan and thought they were our allies, that they will defeat the Soviet Union. We were not aware of the blowback effect that they will that this thing will come and haunt us.
Have you been running into any problems as an Arab American since September 11th? You know, are you being looked at with any suspicion or hostility?
The short answer is yes, but also I think as somebody who is American and who also educated, I sort of appreciate the gravity of the moment, and sort of it's expected. And I think the sad thing is that the only sad thing for me is that I cannot express my sadness and anger at what happened without being looked at as disingenuous in a way, and that makes your feeling, the feeling of sadness when you say it and then it looks on the face of the recipient of that message as something that has no meaning or not sticking, is a horrible feeling. You feel hollow inside. So I think that's the heavy price. It's an emotional price.
Are you afraid now? Are you walking around with a lot of fear on both counts? I'm stereotyping because you're Arab American, but just, you know, a larger fear of another terrorist attack.
In my mind, I think that's the ceiling of terror. That this is the ceiling of what will take place, and I don't expect any attacks to take place again, because these guys think in sports terms. They scored a big goal, and any operation that might falter next will overshadow this one. I think they want to go out with a bang, as they say. So the idea that they will try again something else is not in my mind. I think my worry is that we go into here a witch hunt in terms of Arabs and Muslims and all of that. But at the same time, I think also Muslims and Arabs ought to also look into the gravity of the moment and also see why people get angry. And I think it would be certain inconveniences come with the territory. It might not be a big problem for if I were called, let's say, by an FBI agent asking me for 1 hour of my time to tell them what I know. I wouldn't consider that to be any form of harassment. I think we should all give of our time at a moment of distress in the country, and it's a country that we live in. This is where we make our living, and this is the place that we came here to better our lives, and sort of to get sidetracked by focusing on what the general public call it me kind of attitude is extremely dangerous. I'm aware of the danger around me, but also I think I can avoid that danger, and of course can also appreciate the anger that exists in society. And and probably, unlike most Americans who grew up here, when you grow up in a place where there was terrorism around you, you take precautions generally. Even the way you walk, the way you enter the subway, and things like that, you are alert. It's not like the general public who was complacent throughout and doesn't see the signals.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mamoun Fendi is a professor at the Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies at the National Defense University. He's the author of the book Saudi Arabia and the Politics of Dissent. Our interview was recorded this morning. Coming up, our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz on why he hasn't felt much like listening to music lately. This is Fresh Air. Our classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that although music is usually a source of comfort in a time of crisis, he hasn't been feeling much like listening to music lately.
The problem is that I'm not sure I want to be comforted. The day of the terrorist attack, I turned to poetry, not music. All things fall and are built again, Yeats says in his poem Lapis Lazuli. Hamlet and King Lear, he says, if worthy their prominent part in the play, do not break up their lines to weep. Yet all I felt like doing was cry. The day after, when our possible response to the tragedy became as frightening as the attack itself, I was reading a different Yeats poem, a poem he wrote during the Irish Civil War, a prayer, really, for sweetness and renewal, called The Stare's Nest by My Window. Stare is the Irish word for starling. We have fed the heart on fantasies, the heart's grown brutal from the fair, more substance in our enmities than in our love. O honeybees, come build in the empty house of the stare. On the weekend, I went to hear an old friend in a chamber music concert given at the Friends Meeting House in Cambridge by a group called Sarasa, a group that does a lot of community service. It was the concert they had planned, no special music in response to the horrible events. And I was moved and warmed by the charm and loveliness of the program. Haydn, beautiful and restrained. A colorful musical picture by Boccherini of Spanish street life at night, inventive and appealing, and a rhapsodic quintet by Dvorak. Just music, with no message, and played in the spirit of loving cooperation, as if to say it's music itself that's important. It's part of what's best about human beings. By Sunday, I wanted to hear more music. A Bach cantata performed during the service at Boston's Emmanuel Church. It was one with a powerful, sublime aria about sacrifice for love, music with a dark but explicit spiritual message. I wasn't much comforted by the strictly Christian message of the sermon, but the profundity of the music, the intensity of the performance, moved me far beyond the self-congratulatory bromides of organized religion. During the Gulf War, I said on Fresh Air that music was not just consoling, that it makes us feel a little less helpless, that if the human spirit is capable of such sweetness and generosity, such harmony, there's still a chance it might survive. But this time, that's not what I feel, though it's something I'd still like to believe. This time I feel frightened about our very survival and overwhelmed by the devastation, the evil human beings are capable of, and music isn't likely to change that. The season has just started. I'm a critic. I had to cover an opera. I shouldn't have been startled to hear the orchestra begin with the familiar notes of the Star-Spangled Banner. It was written during the War of 1812, the last time before September 11th that a foreign invader attacked us on home soil. This was the first time since the terrorist attack I was in an audience asked to sing it. I'm nervous about patriotic music, about flag-waving and saber-rattling in general. But this time, as the melody of that old drinking song began to soar on the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting in air, making the words, as always, so hard to sing, our national anthem has never seemed so chillingly real. I'm looking forward to more music. I want our cultural life to continue, and I want to be part of it. I also want to be reassured that art consists of more than a simple message of grief or defiance or consolation. I'm looking forward to more music. I'm just dreading the requiems.
Lloyd Schwartz is the classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and director of the Creative Writing Program at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Well, we're feeling ready to get back to some music on Fresh Air. Yesterday, I recorded a concert with singer-songwriter and guitarist Nick Lowe. We'll hear it sometime next week. In the meantime, we'll close with a song from Nick Lowe's new CD, The Convincer. I'm Terry Gross.
When you feel you're all in and you've decided you can't win, tell yourself it won't be for long, you're between dark and dawn. You've got too much time, you can't kill, your wheels are spinning but you're standing still. It's so flat and forlorn, in between dark and dawn. You're so blue, you can't see, one day all this will be history. Now I've been a fool, but I'm not wrong, you're between dark and dawn. You're between dark and dawn, between dark and dawn, that's where nothing's always.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Anchor Books, paperback publishers of the new novel by Margaret Atwood, The Blind Assassin. From PBS, presenting Life 360, a new series that explores life's surprises, starting next week on Friday nights at 9. Local times may vary. And from Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of She Still Haunts Me, a novel by Katie Royfe about Lewis Carroll and Alice, his muse. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, thinking about city life and architecture in the wake of the attacks on the World Trade Center. We talk with Anthony Vidler, acting dean of the Cooper Union School of Architecture in Manhattan, and we talk with Rick Burns. His documentary series about New York is showing on public TV. Join us for the next Fresh Air.